equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon. I'm Carl Ettenayer, today's host for Equal Time Radio, every Monday. My theme, as usual, is energy, food, and the local economy after the age of oil. If you want to read a blog on the same theme, my blog is called Relocalizing Vermont. It's one of the many blogs at the Vermont Commons website, vtcommons.org/blog. And we're now posting audio of the show afterwards, usually within 24 hours or so of when we're live here on the air. It's at equaltimeradio.com. That's equaltimeradio.com. Got a great show coming up for you today. Times are changing fast. How do we learn the new skills we need and change our lives the way we say we want to? You know, gardening seems easy enough in concept. It's putting seeds in the soil, nurturing the plant, but it actually involves a whole lot of new skills for many people. Joseph Kiefer of Foodworks in Montpelier will describe his work coaching people in gardening, and a whole lot more, it seems. And the same sort of coaching might be useful for saving energy in the home. David Eggleton of Applied Ecologics in Massachusetts. He's looking for a market niche for energy coaches, and he'll tell us why the idea makes sense. And here in Vermont, Washington Electric Co-op has been operating a pledge program to help its members reduce their electric bills. General Manager Avram Pat is going to describe the program's successes and how it works, of course, and where it's fallen short. A few things to take care of first, though. First, I want to give a salute to Paul Harvey. Paul Harvey, longtime radio newscaster with his The Rest of the Story and his regular newscasts, died at age 92. I read in the paper it was Saturday or Friday, and he's been doing radio news since before I can remember, and you know, heard his voice a lot over the years, and really enjoyed listening to him. So sad to see that radio pioneer leave us. Me, I just turned 46 on Saturday, and I ate lunch at the Senior Center here in Waterbury today. There's no connection, really. The definition of a senior at the center seems to be 60 years, but not everybody there was 60 years old. I met a couple little girls there. Natalie, she's 51 years shy of being a senior. Her little sister, Madeline, will become a senior in 53 years. Hey, it's quite a deal for lunch there. It's $5 if you're 60 or over, $6 for the rest of us, or whatever you want by donation, more than above that. Pretty good food today. Ham, carrots, cabbage, fruit, ambrosia, cornbread, and some cake donated by La Brioche. So if you're in downtown Waterbury and looking for lunch, well, there are good restaurants that advertise on WDV, and there's also the Senior Center as an alternative. And apropos of today's show, they're starting a garden this year. They've got a garden plot outside of town, and just this morning they planted tomatoes and other plants, so they'll have seedlings to take out there and transplant. They got them growing right in the window of the Senior Center. So everybody's getting into gardening. One more little thing to take care of before we move on to the show. Power Shift 09 happened over the weekend and is continuing to happen right now. Regular listeners to the show may remember me talking with Bill McKibben a little over a month ago, who, along with Wendell Berry and some other people, have organized what they hope will be the largest civil disobedience action in the U.S. To protest climate change. They had 12,000 high school and college students gathering in D.C. over the weekend as part of this Power Shift 09. And they continued today. They're meeting with members of Congress. They're rallying on the steps of the Capitol, and they're getting ready to commit civil disobedience at the coal plant, which provides electricity for the U.S. Capitol, saying we want an end to the use of coal, and that begins right here. Well, I've been trying to keep up with what's going on today. There's capitalclimateaction.org telling you what's happening there, and the last was at 12:45. They got a blog, 12:45, saying 15 minutes out, hundreds are gathered in the Spirit of Justice Park. The atmosphere is charged with hope and excitement. People are bundled up in their warmest coats and staying active by chanting, I hear, coal can never be clean. and there's a prayer vigil in the south section of the park. So I'm not sure who's doing this blog, but it is at the official website for Capital Climate Action. So if I remember at the end of the show, I'll go back and give you some more information on that. But I thought it was interesting that the action has already had an effect. Capital Hill moves to green DC coal plant. That is, the verb is to green the DC coal plant. This is in businessgreen.com. Democratic leaders outline proposals to stop using coal at Washington, DC's symbolic power plant, posted this morning by the businessgreen.com staff. In what could be a highly symbolic confirmation of the Obama administration's opposition to traditional coal-fired power, Democratic leaders last week announced plans to convert the U.S. Capital Power to burn only gas. The plant, which opened in 1910 and provides steam and chilled water to heat and cool buildings on Capitol Hill, has become a powerful symbol of U.S. reliance on coal, with a number of senators from coal-rich states repeatedly opposing attempts to switch to cleaner fuels. According to figures from the architect of the Capitol's office, which runs a plant, natural gas provided about 65% of its power in 2008, while about 35% came from burning coal, down from 49% in 2007. Now Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid are calling for the use of coal at the plant to be eradicated altogether and have requested the architect's office to provide realistic budget numbers on retrofitting the plant to switch to burning gas full time. So it must be kind of heartening for the people down there to find that they're getting that sort of result even before they commit their civil disobedience this afternoon. So we'll see where that goes. Anyway, on to today's show. Today's show is about learning new skills, changing our lives through doing it, and it can be difficult to do. New skills come hard. The old saying about not being able to teach an old dog new tricks isn't exactly true, but there's a lot of truth to it. And we're going to hear from several people who have thought about that and are working on that. And our first guest, Joseph Kiefer, who's the co-director of FoodWorks in Montpelier, unfortunately bowed out of a live appearance because he's got a conflicting meeting this afternoon. However, I did manage to get an interview with him this morning, and we'll listen to that, and then we'll bring up David Eggleton of Applied Ecologics in Massachusetts talking about taking the same sort of coaching model that FoodWorks is using in gardening and using it in energy. Here's my interview this morning with Joseph Kiefer.
Okay.
Joseph Kiefer, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Carl, and always I want to thank you for the great work you're doing with your radio show here.
Thank you. So our theme today, Joseph, is how people learn new skills and the importance of coaching. Gardening seems like it's simple. Put the seeds in the ground, nurture the plants, keep down the weeds, and then harvest. But there are hundreds of decisions to make in every one of those steps. And you've worked with people who've never gardened before. How have you done that?
Well, I thank you for that question, because I really believe we're facing the greatest challenge we may have ever faced in learning how to feed ourselves again. We've had two or three decades really off the farm, and we've forgotten a lot. We've kind of gotten used to fast food and a certain sense that all of our food is always there whenever we want it. And I think there's a huge learning curve unfolding in front of us at this very moment of so many people realizing for their own food security, irregardless of their economic status, that that food security is going to be built on us learning how to feed ourselves again, family by family, community by community, neighborhood by neighborhood, school by school. So in answering your question, I could start with schools, but actually I thought I would start with some of the work we've been doing in the last 3 years in housing projects.
Sure.
Which I find fascinating as well. Where one of our programs is called Good Food, Good Medicine. It's coordinated by our staff, Ann Mall. And she's basically, it's a month by month, it's a monthly with a focus on the seasons, cooking, gardening, food preservation class. So clearly at this part of the year, there's no growing going on, so we're cooking winter foods.
So when you say monthly, you mean all through the winter as well?
All through the winter. And what we have here are primarily women, single moms, but there are a few fathers, who attend our monthly classes. And what we're learning is probably basically the fundamentals in teaching and learning is that people you know, if you can create and cultivate a relationship, people feel safe and open to hands-on learning.
Mm.
So our classes aren't theoretical and they're not lecture-based. They're always hands-on doing with people and not doing for people. I mean, ultimately, if we're looking at hunger prevention, the best way to really think long-term and end hunger is by teaching everyone to grow their own food again.
And so you talk about the long-term relationship. It sounds like you have people who don't just come to class as a one-off thing one time, but they come to a whole range of classes over many months.
Exactly. And in fact, there's a group that's in its third year.
Hmm.
And what we've built in then is that the second year of these students find another person in the community, in this case in a housing site, in this case Barry, Highgate Housing, and they bring in another person, so as a mentor, coaching mentor, similar. So we actually act as the facilitators and help coordinate the class, but we have now is peer learning going on. People who have been through the cycle once are now helping to teach others how to cook from scratch, how to learn the basics of nutrition, how to not only grow, because that's one thing, but how to care for and tend your garden, and then how to harvest and preserve some of your harvest.
Boy, there's a saying that you never really understand something unless until you've tried to explain it to someone else. So that's got to be really valuable for their learning as well as for teaching the people who need to be mentored from the beginning.
It is. And there's an excitement in that when one realizes they now have a new set of skills that they didn't have prior.
Mm.
So let's walk to the garden, if you will, and imagine it's May. And up at Highgate, we have a number of raised beds, and we're in the conversation now. Let's see how it unfolds. Looking at a 10-year plan, and we're looking at a 10-year plan at this housing site for food self-sufficiency.
Okay.
As much as we can. So we're looking at a foodscape or an edible landscape, and we're looking at how do we turn a community room into a processing kitchen, teaching kitchen. We're looking at root cellaring, many of the cellars. We're looking at, you know, people would graduate from the community garden after they prove themselves for a year. Then we're going to move on to little backyard kitchen gardens, as well as fruit trees, small fruits, berries, and probably some wide row community production along the edges of where the land is.
So what's the distinction between backyard community gardens and backyard kitchen gardens and the community garden?
Well, it's like when you graduate and have proven yourself, you'll then have the ability to have a garden right at your door.
Okay.
Which is everyone's first choice, but the history of this housing site specifically is that at times they start out with a lot of excitement and then they become abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have learned, Carl, is that the teaching garden is a really effective tool. When we show up, let's say from 5 to 7, and we're out there fixing the compost, doing any number of tasks that need to be done, people start coming out and the conversation continues. And then it gets down to the teachable moment where it may not be a formalized curriculum at points, but it's people asking specific questions they have and us being able to respond working alongside. What we're going to do this year, if funding works, is have probably every other week classes in the garden where we'll bring a portable stove, frying pan or wok, and actually do some teaching in the teaching garden, but then do some harvesting and cooking. Because as easy it is for many of us to understand planting the seed or transplanting the transplant and bringing it into production, dealing with insects and dealing with watering and dealing with mulching and so on, is that sometimes the disconnection of then you harvest it and what do you do with it?
So are you going to be using root vegetables stored over the winter in the beginning, or are you going to wait until you have some fresh harvest from this year to start cooking it?
Fresh harvest, which okay. could be, you know, whether it's spinaches, greens, zucchini and yellow squash. As soon as things are ready, then we will be basically harvesting whatever's ready, fresh herbs and so on, and starting to utilize them and cooking a simple little meal.
Mm.
So we really want people to have a taste immediate as it's pulled out of the garden. we're going to then show how we can cook it and turn it into something that's really delicious to eat.
So how do people identify themselves, or how do you identify people to enroll in this class?
It's basically a word-of-mouth volunteer. At Highgate or at Green Acres or at Cumming Street here in Montpelier, we're reaching out, trying to build this web, trying to, we at times do follow, we do phone calls as reminders. So it can be labor-intensive, but we're working on building leadership teams at each of these sites of people who then become the ones who are making the phone calls and doing the reminding.
Hmm.
And as the price of food continues and as the price of fuel will continue to climb, we're seeing huge desire by people who want to learn these new skills, who really want to put food up, who really want to learn how to cook. So that makes the task so much easier, because
right.
there's no resistance. It's just like people didn't learn these skills. They weren't passed down from grandparents. For whatever numerous reasons, they were never part of a skill set that one had in their childhood up into becoming an adult. So now we're starting from just desire, and it's all filled with wonder. I mean, it's extremely exciting as people harvest their first carrot pulled out of the ground that there's a carrot there.
Mm.
So we're working with that, and that's a great thing, that the excitement and the interest is so there.
Mm. So I'm living in one of these apartments where you're doing this teaching garden, and I decide that I want to enroll in the course. What's the first thing I see when I come to the first class in the spring?
It probably would depend on what month. As we're pushing March and April, we'll be working with starting seedlings, and people will be taking home flat, you know, 6 packs to 12 packs of plants as seeds that they will nurture and grow.
Mm-hmm.
Then as we move towards May, we'll be in the garden turning the beds, putting compost on the beds. People will identify and then have all the beds are numbered, so they'll be able to, we have a grid and it's all coordinated through the office, and so they'll be able to adopt a bed for their own growing for the growing year.
Mm.
And then it's about showing up. You know, and it's about us showing up. But what we've learned is by showing up and being available, people come out and want to learn, and next thing you know, they're asking questions, and, you know, we'll start to formalize that emerging curriculum a little bit more this year, but we've learned that there's just a tremendous amount of learning can take place just by being available and letting that teachable moment unfold.
So you've talked about the great desire that people have to learn these gardening skills now, and you're showing up there every week teaching them. Questions come up. Do the questions sometimes go beyond gardening?
Oh, you know, it's the same. It's storytelling like in Fear in the Kitchen. You know, as we do classes around food and, you know, whatever ingredients we're working on, whether we're making a parsnip cake or a root soup, conversations start to happen about people's lives, about their concerns, about their fears. It's like life anywhere else, in a kitchen or in a garden. People start talking and sharing what's going on for them.
Mm.
And so you learn a lot. I mean, I work with our staff to say we are students here ourselves, and we're learning how people survive here, and we're going to try to share our skills, but it's a two-way street. It's building relationships with each other.
Mm. The classical thing for new gardeners is to get really excited in the spring and plant many, many row feet of many vegetables that they're all excited about. And then sometime around July, the weeds start taking over and it gets harder and harder to go out there and do anything because you can't find the plants you put in for the weeds. and then a lot of things don't get harvested or don't mature to the point where they get harvested. Do you see that happening? How do you keep that from happening in these teaching classes?
Well, it's kind of like going to the yoga class. If you're in an environment where there's a lot of support, you'll keep doing your yoga. And same thing is true of the garden. If you have if there's a gardening class and there's a set time and people know that there's going to be someone there, then people show up and they get that kind of encouragement. So as we walk through the gardens and we see, you know, there's a huge amount of weeds growing, then we actually are all down on our hands and knees weeding and mulching and doing it together.
Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of showing how it almost can take a community to raise a community garden.
What's the percentage of people who start the course who complete it?
Oh, we've got a group in Highgate 3 years old that basically, this group keeps coming back because what they're saying is it's so much fun. They're learning from, they keep learning new things, and a lot are saying they're learning how to teach.
So did 100% of the group that started 3 years ago finish that first year?
Yeah. There's people who move out,
right?
People who move in. So there's all those variables, but for the most part, what we're seeing is people, it's there, so it's site-based, it's free, and there's food that they make and they take, and there's recipes. So there's a lot of benefits for participants to take these classes.
You've got an idea that works, it sounds like.
Well, I think it's good teaching and learning. You know, it's learning with and being a participant with, creating friendships, building relationships, and really letting the plants in the garden be your teacher. So we're there studying as well. It's not like, oh, we can figure out everything and here's what you do. You really have to look at those specific conditions, whether it's the plant, whether it's the soil, whether you're doing a pH test, whether your plants are showing yellow, you know, and so there's a nutrient deficiency. So it really has to be that we're all become students of this great garden ecosystem.
Yeah, FoodWorks is in one city, Montpelier, works around in different areas. You have a limited number of staff. Who else could replicate this model?
Oh, the model. We've worked and provided training with the Vermont Community Housing Development of many housing sites around the state. I mean, this could be adopted at any housing site as long as you have potentially master gardeners, as long as you have some people who have are thinking about a system, about a plan, and ways to engage participants in gardening, cooking, food preservation.
Do you have anything written that people could follow?
We do. We've got an all year plan.
Well,
month by month.
And how do people find out more about FoodWorks and this whole year plan?
You can call our office at 223-1515 or go to our website, which is tworivercenter.org, spelled out as T-W-O. And if you want to reach me, I'm extension 308, and Ann Mall is extension, I'm not positive, I think it's 302.
Okay, that's 223-1515, extension 308 for Joseph, and 302 for Ann Mall, who teaches the monthly course, or the website tworivercenter, all spelled out, .org.
And Carl, if I could mention real quickly,
yes.
This we're having our first in March 12th gathering of the Central Vermont Food System Council.
Very good.
And there'll be eight committees meeting at City Hall from 6 to 8 p.m. It's a chance for anyone who's concerned about the future of food and farming and growing more food and growing more farmers to feed ourselves in Central Vermont. They're welcome to come, participate, become part of one of the eight committees. And we really are working to both increase the amount of land, increase the amount of farmers, and definitely increase the amount of food we grow, store, and redistribute in Central Vermont.
That's March 12th, starting at 6 p.m., is it?
That's correct. That's City Hall.
In Montpelier.
In Montpelier. And if you need more information, you can call Andy Harper at FoodWorks at 223-1515, extension 301.
223-1515, extension 301. Well, Joseph Kiefer, co-director of FoodWorks, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Carl, very much.
Bye.
Bye.
We're going to be right back to Equal Time with Carl Ettnayer and his guest, David Eggleton of Applied Ecologics in Massachusetts. Just a moment. We just got a call, a gentleman calling in from Interstate 89 southbound. The exit for Montpelier is closed as you come around the bend there. If you're heading southbound on Interstate 89, it's a bit tricky with the weather and everything. Looks like an accident, and that has put everything at a standstill southbound on Interstate 89. We'll keep you informed as the day goes on. And now back to Equal Time with Carl Ettnayer.
I appreciate the callers keeping an eye out there on road conditions for all of us. And the number here, if you want to report other road conditions or if you want to join the conversation about coaching and gardening or about to get into energy here at a moment. The number is 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. 855. That was a pre-recorded interview I did just this morning with Joseph Kiefer of Foodworks in Montpelier. Unfortunately, he was not available to be with us live on the show, but we do have, as Artie was mentioning, David Eggleton from Applied Ecologics in Massachusetts live on the line. Hello, David.
Hi there, Carl.
Good to have you on the show.
I'm glad to be on with you. Thanks.
Well, we just heard from Joseph Kiefer about his work coaching people in gardening. And is this a model that can be applied to saving energy in the home?
It certainly can. And in fact, there's a book about it called The Low Carbon Diet. I have to say, I actually haven't been a facilitator of this program, but it's from the Empowerment Institute, which I believe is based in New York. And it's available in a booklet, and groups of people get together and work their way through the booklet as a team, which enables them to support each other and challenge each other along the way in a kind of peer coaching situation, not unlike what we heard about from Joseph. And something that I was really struck by in listening to what he said was noticing that generally when we use energy, we do it by ourselves. You know, we're alone, or we might be in at home with others, but if we're going to do something, we turn on the thing that enables us to do whatever it is we want to do indoors. And the electricity is there, waiting, so to speak, and we can just do whatever came to mind. We can do it. Not a lot of preparation needed, other than having the devices that will let us play what we want to play or make what we want to make. And it seems different than, you know, dealing with the law of the harvest, where you have to do the spring things in the spring and the summer things in the summer in order to have a harvest in the fall.
Well, there's a time difference, which gives a planning difference, and there's also the space difference. I mean, gardens can be private, tucked away in backyards and up on balconies and such, but they can also be put out in public spaces, as the ones that Joseph Kiefer was describing are, and so you have this neutral space for people to gather and to learn from each other about gardening, where saving energy in the home, as you said, it is in the home that one decides to flip on a light switch or flip off a light switch. So how do you make it safe for people to be working with others to be saving energy in their own homes?
Yep. Well, that's exactly what this book, The Low Carbon Diet, sets out to do. Someone forms a group and serves, well, I mean, there's a lot of ways that responsibilities could be shared. Different people could take responsibilities for different stages of the process and take turns facilitating meetings and or making arrangements and so forth. So there'd be that kind of community there as well. I think the one of the opportunities that I think is a little different in energy coaching is helping people. It's so much of a mindset thing. That was the other thing I was struck by. And what I was alluding to is that there are a lot of skills involved in gardening that are not ones that people had and quit using, at least in this generation. More and more, there's skills that people never had and need to begin to learn and develop and make their own. The energy version of that, or something, is that we've had this supply and this expectation that the supply would always be continuous and constant and even. And we could just go on adding new toys that we did have power switches of one kind or another. And a lot of it involves separating ourselves from a lot of what energy powers is being separate from the living world that at least a lot of us believe we developed in. and came to be what we are in, and almost as if, you know, we don't belong here, and only in our shells can we survive. And so I find myself sometimes seeing lists of things you can do to save energy, and I end up in the comment area saying, and then there's getting out, getting outside, having a relationship with the world that's sunlit, moonlit, starlit, and has fresh air and things to do and places to go, things to grow, things to watch, et cetera, et cetera.
So
challenges to meet, that is just there every day.
So
and,
what's the connection between getting outside and saving energy? Is that you shut off your lights in your house when you go, or that it gives you a different mindset?
Exactly. A programmable thermostat is wonderful. If you're coming and going on some kind of schedule, it sure beats paying attention to a thermostat, if you even would. But on the other hand, if you know you're going for the day, and if you often go for the day to do this or that outdoors, you can set it way back and take one more walk around the block after turning it up and letting your house warm up for you.
Hmm.
So it's, I hate to use the word lifestyle because I like life ways or something, because style relates to fashion and fashion hooks up to fad and short-lived and all that. But a lifestyle that increasingly expects outdoor time can be a much lower energy life, and it doesn't involve all the expenditures that so many other approaches to saving energy do. I'm looking at a brochure that the Northeast Sustainable Energy Association put together of the top 10 most effective ways to save energy in your home. And particularly at a time like this, probably the first four are the main ones that people would consider. And one of them is limited because people have a lot of light fixtures in their home, and replacing every incandescent bulb with compact fluorescent lamps at this moment could be hard to do for people. But the other three I'll just mention, since I've alluded to four of them, are installing a programmable thermostat and having a power strip so that your electronics that are in a standby mode when you're not even using them can be switched off all the way by being plugged into a power strip. And when its on and off switch is used, then they're all really off.
Yeah.
And then the other is to choose a setting of 122 degrees for a water heater and insulate the water heater and the pipes leading from it. After that, you're into expensive things like sealing your house so there are no leaks, buying new appliances, insulating your attic, insulating your walls, insulating your basement walls, and replacing your furnace or boiler. So going green often involves spending green, and it can be prohibitive, but there are things, and that's what I wanted to emphasize by starting with get out of the house, is by having an active lifestyle that involves a lot of time outdoors, a lot of things, a lot of heating needs can be reduced.
And then remember that you can reduce your heating needs and turn off your lights and turn off your internet modem and things like that when you do go out the door. You mentioned a couple times now this book, Low Carbon Diet, and I just want to mention that we have a number of organizations that are working with that here in Vermont. The one that's most active that I'm aware of is Vermont Interfaith Power and Light. We had Betsy Hardy, who's co-director or something with them, on the show back in October, and they are forming at churches and synagogues and mosques in Vermont. They're forming eco-teams of people who read this book and take steps together, coaching each other on how to reduce their energy use. One great thing about electricity is, and other forms of energy, is that you can get monthly bills that tell you how much you're reducing or increasing your use.
That's right. In Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Climate Action Network is also very big on this, and actually took on a challenge back in November at their annual conference called Cool Mass. And I've actually, the number of communities they're trying to enlist escapes me, but it's a large number. And they're reaching out to a very large number of people to get on these teams and take on this challenge. And it's a very good thing.
Hmm. We're talking with David Eggleton. He's with Applied Ecologics in Massachusetts. And in just a minute, we're going to be joined by Avram Pat. He's a general manager of Washington Electric Co-op. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Ettenayer, and our theme today is how people learn new skills and the importance of coaching in learning those skills. Our telephone numbers are 244-1777 if you're in the Waterbury calling area. Otherwise, give us a call toll-free, 877-291-8255. We've been talking with David Eggleton of Applied Ecologics in Massachusetts, and Dave, you have a blog at woburnite.com, correct?
That's right. It's a new initiative here in Woburn, Massachusetts, to build local community wealth. We're both allowing locally owned businesses to list themselves for free, but we're also trying, especially through the blog, to encourage people to find their niche in the local economy. And hopefully people who are either wanting to supplement their income or have an income if they've lost a job recently, might get some inspiration get some inspiration there. So I'm writing several times a week a variety of angles on local economy.
So that's woburnite.com, W-O-B-U-R-N-I-T-E.
That's right.
.com. Yep. And we also have on the line Avram Pat, the general manager of Washington Electric Co-op, where I'm a member of. I buy my electricity from them in East Montpelier, and it's a member-owned cooperative. And he's here to describe a pledge program that the co-op put together. Avram, welcome back to Equal Time.
Hi, Carl. Great to be here.
So we were on the radio 6 months, 9 months ago, it seems, a while back, and you were describing a program that Washington Electric was just putting together to help its customers save money through some sort of self-coaching. Well, why don't you describe it?
Okay, we called it the Pledge Program, and what we were doing was really, it was a pilot program where we set out, we knew at the outset that we're going to be trying to do some different things. And I should say that we were, for purposes of this program, focusing on residential and really rural residential electric customers, because that's almost entirely who our membership is. And so we were wanting to, the co-op had been enthusiastically involved in energy efficiency and conservation work going back to the 1980s, really, when Efficiency Vermont was started in Vermont and took over a lot of the functions that individual utilities had either been doing like we had or not doing. We decided after a few years of that what we wanted to do was to get our members to participate and do these things at an even greater rate than Vermonters in general. And Efficiency Vermont does a great job, but we just wanted our members to be participating even more. And we called the program The Pledge as we were designing it, really because what we wanted to do was get people to really take a look at how they're using energy in their home, particularly electricity, but we were going to go beyond our own business and have them ask them to look at their thermal energy, their heating as well, while they were looking at their house, and to take a pledge, to really take make a commitment to do some things and to try to measure whether they had actually succeeded in reducing their usage. And if they got all the way through that with a fair amount of individualized coaching on the phone mostly, then we would give them an additional incentive as a thank you for having done that.
And what was the incentive?
I'm sorry?
If they completed the program, what was the incentive that you would give them?
The intent, they would get help, certain incentives. Let's say they changed an appliance, and Efficiency Vermont already has an incentive for changing your refrigerator and getting a more efficient one. We were willing to add some incentives on top of that, but mostly we were going to pay a relatively modest cash payment at the end of the process if you can measure that you actually, on a systematic and consistent basis, reduced your monthly usage. We would give you a little bonus, really designed to be a thank you. The main financial reward, of course, is your ongoing savings, not any little incentives that the co-op or Efficiency Vermont give you. In the end, you really benefit most simply by using less.
And this was targeted at whom?
We were targeting residential customers, particularly those who were using more than the average or high users, although we weren't shutting the door and saying people couldn't come in. But what we were hoping to attract was people at the higher end of usage.
And then people could select for themselves how much electricity or how much energy they were going to save over the time period of the program, right?
That's right. We were working closely with the people at Efficiency Vermont, and they assigned some of their trained and capable staff to essentially do a detailed phone interview with the person and talk through what they were using energy for now, estimating about how much each of those uses was taking up, how many people were in the home, and all of that, and then to identify on a case-by-case basis where the best and easiest opportunities probably were for them to achieve savings. So if they were already using not that much electricity, they wouldn't be encouraged to start out by pledging to reduce their usage by another 30% if that didn't seem quickly reasonable. So they'd have a more modest goal, let's say.
So what sort of goals did you find people choosing?
People were choosing anywhere from 10 to 30%. This is on electric usage. And then we also had some people who chose to follow up with the home performance through Efficiency Vermont and take a look at their non-electric usage, insulation and heating usage as well.
Mm. And how many people signed up for the program?
Well, this is where it gets interesting. We experimented with, different kinds of marketing and hooks to get people's attention. And what we found was, after a while, with some fits and starts, we found some methods that got a lot of people's attention and got about 1,600 people to make contact with the program. That's over 10% of our membership, which is good. Of those, about 600 went through the full interview process, and we're still waiting to see at this point how many people make it all the way through to the end of the program and get back to us and say, I think I met my pledge goal. Where's my incentive? Where's my reward? Mm. We're still waiting to see those numbers. It will be a smaller number, for us, to have engaged with 1,600 people, to have engaged even more actively through a full kind of interview process with 600 is pretty successful from my point of view. How much we can measure in the end of what people exactly did and exactly how much savings, we're still in the process of evaluating that right now, and we'll make some decisions in the next few months together with our board of directors in terms of what the program looks like in the future.
What we've heard earlier in the program through Joseph Kiefer of Foodworks in Montpelier talking about the ongoing gardening and food use classes that Foodworks has at Section 8 housing apartments in Montpelier and Barrie, and talking to David Eggleton about the low carbon diet book where people form groups who get together and coach each other, is that an important component of getting people to stick with things like this is just that frequent contact with other people. Has a pledge program had any of that other than you get the utility bills every month, and that gives you feedback, of course?
Yes, we obviously contact our members that way on a monthly basis. But one of the things that we were looking to do and that we had through the Efficiency Vermont staff was the ability to actually have, at least for a limited period of time, some ongoing back and forth and conversations with a knowledgeable person about energy efficiency. We're a small company, and we were really not really staffed to be able to do that on an ongoing basis with large numbers of people. We do have a member of our staff here, Bill Powell, who takes calls pretty much every day from people with questions like this, but he's not really set up to take hundreds of calls. And that's what we were able to get with Efficiency Vermont, was a really customized approach, because everybody's home and household situation is different, and what's going to save energy in one home is not necessarily the place to start in another home. And that's, we wanted to get away from a one-size-fits-all approach.
Mm. Now, another program that Efficiency Vermont has been behind in our area for the city of Montpelier, the towns of East Montpelier, Marshfield, and Plainfield at least, and I'm sure there are others that I'm not aware of, is a citizen mobilization program where they train people to go into people's homes and do a very simple energy audit that you can get training for in 2-3 hours, and then come in with some volunteers to actually help make some changes. So it's neighbors helping neighbors. And there are some, I think there's 30 or more people signed up just in East Montpelier, Marshfield, and Plainfield to be doing this. Is that something that Washington Electric has worked with them on?
We are in touch with the energy committees in all of the towns in our area that have energy committees, and where they have organized to do what you're saying, Carl, we are in touch with them. I think in most cases, and what I'm most hopeful about, having in my previous job before I worked at the co-op, been responsible for the low-income weatherization program at the state level, is that people will really be able to focus this way on thermal energy uses, which in most homes is the largest energy use and where the most energy is being wasted now. We've done a fairly good job, at least compared to some other places, around electricity. And in most homes, that's not the largest electric use. What really is what is the heat and whatever people are using to heat their water with, but particularly their heat. And in old Vermont housing stock, when you drive by a house with ice dams on the roof, you know that at least 30% of the heat energy is being wasted there.
Mm. Well, Efficiency Vermont would like to get this program, get people run through this program by sometime in April, and that's coming up. And I should have a name of a person at Efficiency Vermont for people to contact for more information. But what I do on my other show, which is more localized to the greater Plainfield area, is give out Dave Grundy's name in East Montpelier. And I'm hoping he's not going to get mad at me if I give it out in this larger broadcast area. But,
too late now.
Yeah, 476-4300 is his phone number if you want to find out about getting your home visited by one of these volunteers. And Efficiency Vermont is offering all sorts of freebies to people who participate in this, including a programmable thermostat.
Yes.
And I'd like to go back to David Eggleton on the line from Ecologics in, Applied Ecologics in Massachusetts, and just get your thoughts, David, on what you've heard about these programs.
Oh, it sounded wonderful, and it also brought to mind a private initiative in Massachusetts called the Energy Smackdown, which is actually a contest that's been through two iterations or two versions, growing the idea of engaging households either on their own or in concert with other households in their community to actually compete with groups from other communities on reducing household energy use. And it seems that people enjoy rising to the challenge of saving more energy than others. And so in hearing about the pledge, I wondered if, short of making it a competition, if you had wondered, Evram, if there was a way, a website where people could see how all the pledgers were doing, even anonymously, like if they had an alias, if they chose one, if there was a kind of a scoreboard where people could see that I'm one of the X percent that's exceeding my pledge, and I'm, you know, whatever, if it might actually create another increment of motivation. It's just a question I have based on this, having observed the two rounds so far of the Energy Smackdown.
That's an interesting idea. We don't have that on our website, in part because we've really been, we're experimenting, and we actually changed tactics a couple of times over the course of last year to, you know, figure out what worked best to get people's attention and just get them in the door.
Uh-huh.
We are planning to, in our newsletter, which comes out 10 times a year, to write about some of the people who made it through it. But if we continue the program and, you know, along the lines of what we have now, that's actually a very interesting idea, to let people see how they're doing live. While we do have to keep, you know, people's individual usage confidential, so it would have to be a kind of a blind system. But people, some of the participants could actually be, I'll say, mildly competing against each other. We're not going to say that one person did better than is a better person than the other, but just to get people to say, well, if that person got their usage down to that amount, maybe I could too.
A lot of organizations use awards to recognize individuals who've achieved something. Are there people who, you know, give out signs to people who can put in their front yard saying, I am a Washington Electric, or whatever their utility is, Energy Saver of the Month or something?
Excuse me. I'm aware of programs where, I don't know about signs on the lawn, but basically kind of a decal to put on your door. Kind of thing. And again, we know that we want to recognize people that achieve what they said they were going to do, and as we experiment with the program, we'll probably figure out what the best way to do that is. Certainly in our newsletter, which a large percent of our members read, if we put someone's picture in there and a description of what they actually did, that'll get a lot of attention.
That's right. Well, we're almost out of time. David Eggleton, do you have anything you want to add?
Oh, not on the tip of my tongue, Carl.
Okay. Well, if people want to learn more about the way you think about energy savings and some similar questions, you have a website.
That's right. It's www.appliedecologics.com.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Carl.
And Avram Pat, the Washington Electric Co-op, has a website as well.
Yes, it's Washington Electric, all one word, .coop.
Okay, anything you'd like to add?
Just that people, I get the sense that people are paying more attention to their energy usage than they were a few years ago, and that it's real this time. Interest will always go up and down a little bit, but I think it's real, and I hope we can start paying as much attention to our transportation energy use as we have been to electricity.
Right, that's a big one for us here. Well, Avram Pat, the general manager of Washington Electric Co-op, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And I promised at the beginning of the show that I'd get back to the Capital Climate Action blog. That's capitalclimateaction.org, about their protests and civil disobedience at the coal-fired power plant that provides electricity to the U.S. Capitol, going on right now. The crowd, which has got to be at least 2,000 people, they report, is preparing to walk down to the coal plant. I just walked by the plant, and there are police everywhere. We're about to start posting photo and video in a few minutes, so you can keep up with that yourself. I think the moral of today's show is, if you want to do something yourself, work with others. I like what Joseph Kiefer said in the beginning of the show. It takes a community to raise a community garden, and it seems to be the same with energy. So when you see lists of things individuals can do to save energy or eat more local food, you know, keep in mind that almost all of us do better working with others. I'm Carl Ettner. That's it for today's Equal Time. Travin's in tomorrow. Anthony Polina will host Wednesday and Thursday. I'll be back next Monday. Check EqualTimeRadio.com for podcasts. And thanks to Artie Levine for engineering. Stay tuned for Jack Donovan, and thanks for tuning in.